I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, as part of American Graduate, our continuing community conversation about education and the importance of moving students to graduation, we're going to talk about the state of early learning in Indiana. Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee has submitted its 2015 report of findings to Governor Mike Pence and the state's Legislative Council. We'll discuss the findings. My guests are Kevin Bain, President and CEO of Wellborn Baptist Foundation, and Amanda Lopez, President of Transform Consulting Group. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about early learning, early education here on No Limits. Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee has submitted its 2015 report of findings to Governor Mike Pence and the state's Legislative Council. We're going to talk about what those findings are and what they mean ultimately for the state of Indiana. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests were both intimately involved in the process of gathering these findings. We have with us Kevin Bain, who is the president and CEO of Wellborn Baptist Foundation, and Amanda Lopez, president of Transform Consulting Group. Welcome to both of you.
John, thanks so much. Appreciate your having us.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Certainly. Well, let's talk a little bit. Give me an overview first about what the Early Learning Advisory Committee is and what you were charged to discover.
Okay. Yeah, I'll start with that. So the Early Learning Advisory Committee was actually created in fall of 2013. So we've only been about this work for basically the last couple of years. It was created for a number of reasons, but essentially to be kind of a central source of hopefully best practice-based recommendations and baseline informations on what the state of Indiana looks like. What is the current state of early learning in Indiana? The Early Learning Advisory Committee is a relatively small group. There's only eight of us who are members, but we've been successful in these last couple of years to get over 140 volunteers from around the state who are passionate about this issue, and they serve in a series of work groups that tackle different aspects of early learning.
Who are the eight members?
The eight members are they represent actually both the public sector and the private sector, which I think is a good balance. In addition to myself, a gentleman from Eli Lilly named Alonzo Weems is a member, a lady representing the faith-based community, and an actual provider, Tammy Veselsky from Traders Point Christian Academy, Melanie Brizzy, who heads up the Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning for the state, is a member, as is Charlie Gayer, who is from the Department of Education here in Indiana. Connie Sherman, who is also a provider, heads a provider. She's from St. Mary's Child Care Center. And John Burnett, who is from Columbus, Indiana, and part of the Community Education Coalition. Those are the members.
And what was the charge? You know, obviously, when we talk about Early Learning Advisory Committee, that could go in a lot of different directions. What were you supposed to do when you all got together?
Great question. The charge to us from the governor was to essentially assess the opportunities and the challenges that the state was up against in trying to mobilize a more coordinated approach to taking the resources that were already here and getting them to communicate with one another, perhaps a little bit better, to identify where we were, to baseline where we were as a state, and then also to make some recommendations in terms of some maybe some quick wins that would demonstrate progress. And so that's kind of what we've been tasked with.
And Amanda, how did you get pulled into this whole process?
Well, as Kevin mentioned, he mentioned the word volunteers. And so all of the eight members of ELEC have been appointed and are giving graciously of their time and talent to this work. And then we've been able to pull in over 140 members across the state to participate in seven different work groups on some key issues related to that. And so my company provides project staff support, what we call the backbone support, to all of these volunteers to help ensure that we are moving the agenda forward and the issues that ELEC has identified. They have some resources to help behind the scenes gather that data, coordinate some of the information, and do some of those follow-up to make sure that we're not dropping the ball and we're staying on top of these key issues.
And again, we should talk about what the issues were were identified and also you know, how you went about identifying those issues, what the process was there.
I think the people involved were very familiar with the issues. I think because it's such a complex issue around early childhood, what we tried to do is come up with ways to get our hands around it. And so early on, as we discussed that, we really landed on a focus on three aspects of early childhood education. The first of those is accessibility, just basically seats available for kids to take full advantage of this. The second one is affordability. And we've got some numbers that are in the report, but it's a very expensive proposition for parents to send their kids to childcare. And then the third aspect of it that we wanted to focus on was high quality. So it's not just a matter of a seat anywhere, but how could we be sure that the kids were getting the kind of high-quality early education experience that research shows will actually deliver the kind of results we were looking for? So those three areas are what we focused on.
Okay, and how did you go about doing the research then?
Well, we because of the volunteers who were actively involved, you may want to speak to this as well, we had a lot of people with access to information. They were already part of the 140-strong volunteer force. The trick was all of this information resides in different kind of pockets within the state. So some's in IDOE, some's in the health department, some's within FSSA department that Melanie Brizzi is part of. And so the challenge is how do we see if we can come alongside and help it not to be siloed, but bring it together so that we can get a comprehensive picture of what it looks like for early childhood.
Well, and I'll throw this, I guess, to Amanda, but since your function here was really to sort of keep everyone on task, it sounds like.
Amen.
And to make sure that the results that were being gathered had some meaning. You know, the danger with an all-volunteer organization is you can get a lot of really, really wonderful anecdotal information that really doesn't give you anything like the data you need to make public policy decisions. So how did you go about testing the validity of the information that you were getting?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one of the great benefits of what ELEC has been able to do is really get our hands around what information is available. First, figuring out what do we want to know, and then how can we get answers to those key questions. And so as Kevin alluded to, a lot of people are involved and have different pockets of information. Education has some of those answers, and FSSA has some of those answers, and even in the private sector, we have some of that information. And so I think the first time ELEC has been able to really pull all of those different entities together, and that's what's reflected in this this year's report, is a baseline understanding of the current state in early learning Indiana. And then we've been able to really start to peel the onion back, if you will, and drill down a little bit deeper into saying, what are some of those key areas that we really want to focus on? And that's what the dashboard in the report kind of highlights, four key categories that seem to be really supporting those three focus areas, as Kevin had mentioned in the beginning. And then what we've also learned is there's a lot of opportunities for improvement as well. And I think that kind of gets back to the question that you're asking, John, about verifying that information. And a lot of times this is the first time somebody outside of those agencies is asking for that information and really providing a second set of eyes and understanding how is this information collected, And maybe there are ways that we can better improve that data so we can answer some of these questions that are important to stakeholders.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about early education, early learning opportunities here in Indiana. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So we've walked through the process of how it was gathered, and you've collected information from all of these sources and tried to pull it out of the silos, which raises the big question then. What did you find?
Great question. Let me give you some headlines, and then, Amanda, you may want to highlight some other things. So just the raw numbers, Indiana has about 500,000 children who are age 0 to 5. Mm-hmm. About two-thirds of those kids need some kind of care because their parents work. They either come from dual-parent households where both parents work, or they come from single-parent households. So you got roughly 330,000 of those 500,000 kids that need to be somewhere. They need some kind of care. But what we found when we pulled together the information that Amanda was talking about was only about 11%, only about 37,000 of those kids are actually in what we would consider to be high-quality early childhood care. Now, the others are someplace. Some of them are in perhaps lower level, lower quality care, formal care. Others, frankly, are with their family members or with a friend or a neighbor down the street because they've got to be somewhere. Their parents are not there. They're working. But it really opened our eyes to see the small percentage of those kids that were in what we would consider to be high quality care.
And again, that deals with that first issue that you talked about, the accessibility.
Absolutely. As well as the quality.
You could talk about availability, too. I noticed you were working with the alliterative. You stayed with the A's on all three of those.
I'm glad that wasn't too subtle.
But if that's the case, and really it's 11% if you count those, you know, from the 330,000.
Correct.
It's less than that if you count the 500,000.
That's
because
absolutely
it means
right.
If things should change for them, there aren't going to be spaces available.
That's
anyhow.
Exactly right.
Okay, so we've got a problem of accessibility, availability. Amanda, is it concentrated in certain parts of the state? You know, are there places that are particularly hard hit where there just aren't good early learning opportunities at all?
You know, that's a great question, and that's part of the research that we've done. And in the report, there are some really interesting appendices, if you want to get kind of into the details, where we've identified this data at the county level. And so many communities could go into their county and identify, how are we doing? Are we doing a good job with having enough seats? And how many of those seats are classified as high quality? Which our definition of high quality, just to explain and clarify, is the pass to quality rating system, a level 3 or level 4, or a nationally accredited program. And so absolutely, there are pockets in the state where we are lacking those high quality seats based on what the need is when we look at the number of families who do need that care, as Kevin talked about.
Well, and since so much of the early childhood learning opportunities, child care, is done, you know, as either a for-profit or not-for-profit enterprise, mm-hmm. both of them require a certain concentration of population. I mean, you're not going to hire qualified support for one child or whatever. I would think that rural communities would be pretty hard hit. Amanda's nodding her head immediately, so we're going to her first.
Yes, you're absolutely right. There are certainly rural communities where they just struggle, and those are the families and the communities that need it the most. And so, but there are some creative examples of partnerships that are available where schools, we're seeing more and more schools who are coming forward and making available preschool and expanding preschool as an option in their community to ensure that high-quality seats are available.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about early education here on No Limits. This conversation is part of American Graduate, our continuing community conversation about education and the importance of moving students to graduation. It is part of a partnership with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, many businesses, and, of course, this station, which wants to leverage the power of public broadcasting to move people to a good outcome. We're talking about the findings from the Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee, which just has submitted those findings to the governor and the state's legislative council. We just discovered that there aren't that many seats available, 11% by the most generous estimate, and probably less than that if we're counting all of the students, young people who could be served. We're going to talk about questions of affordability and access was the other one, I think.
High quality. Come back to that as well.
High quality as well. My guests are Kevin Bain and Amanda Lopez, who helped put together the report. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about early education. The Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee has submitted its 2015 report of findings to Governor Pence and the state's legislative council. We've been talking about those findings with two people who helped assemble them. Kevin Bain, who's the president and CEO of the Wellborn Baptist Foundation and is also a member of the Early Learning Advisory Committee, and Amanda Lopez, who's president of Transform Consulting Group, which, as she says, provided much of the backbone support for the effort. And before we went to the break, we were talking about the fact that there just are not enough seats at the table, not enough seats in the classroom, whatever image you want to use in this state. We probably ought to talk about the next issue that really confronts parents, and that is the affordability. Even if there are seats available where you are, can people afford them?
That's exactly right. The range, this is a staggering number, but the range of what it costs for a year's worth of early childhood education, and it is a range because it's more expensive for infants than it is, say, for four-year-olds. But the range on average runs from about $8,000 a year all the way up to about $11,000 a year for infant care. So if you just look at the math and you think about particularly those families that are living in poverty, and you look at those kinds of costs associated with it, that would be more than a third of the annual income just for one child to go to child care. Be more than a third of their annual income for a family living in poverty. And even if you're at the median income, which is a little less than $60,000, it's still going to take one child. It's still going to take about 15% of your income to cover the cost of that, which is why, particularly for our lower income families, there have been some pilots initiated that we speak about in the report to try to address the affordability of this and provide scholarships to some of these high-quality providers that are so critically important.
And I realize we probably ought to take a step back here and talk about why this is important, why early education, why these opportunities are important for children. I'm going to let each of you have a crack at that, but I'm going to start with Amanda.
Absolutely. Well, there's quite a building of research that really demonstrates the importance of those early years of learning opportunities from 0 to 5, ensuring that all children, when they enter kindergarten, when they enter school, that they are ready to learn and that they're not behind. And so we're realizing that not all children are having the opportunities to attend those high-quality early learning programs. As we found in the report, only 11% are enrolled in those high-quality seats here in Indiana. And so we really want to make sure that the state is staying competitive and that we are having those opportunities to ensure all children are ready to learn.
Kevin, I'll let you have a crack.
Sure. So the thing that makes our communities thrive is to have well-educated people in high-paying jobs. And so early learning is kind of in the scaffolding of what actually makes that possible, because for people to have good-paying jobs, they need to graduate. One of the best predictors of graduation rates is, can they read when they get to third grade? Are they reading at third grade level, appropriate third grade level? Because to that point, you're learning to read. After that point, you read to learn. And if you can't read at third grade, then you're in trouble. One of the best predictors of can you read in the third grade is, do you arrive at kindergarten ready to learn? And one of the best predictors of how you arrive at kindergarten is, have you had this high-quality early childhood educational experience? So it all builds. It's basically what we're trying to do is fill in that front end of the funnel and get kids with a strong start so that they can learn to read, they can be ready when they hit the kindergarten door, ultimately graduate on time and have well-paying jobs and be productive citizens.
So my next question here then is, given that it is that important to both our success as a state, you know, and building thriving communities, I know we have been talking about early learning and early education opportunities here in Indiana for a long time. I remember the late Governor Frank O'Bannon made it the centerpiece of his State of the State address, I think, in 1997, the first year he was elected. That's almost 20 years ago now, and we're still talking about just trying to get this launched, managing to, at best, provide opportunities for, you know, by the most generous estimate, just slightly more than one in 10 of the children who might need this. What is the holdup here? I mean, what is the problem? And I'll start with Kevin, but I want to hear Amanda's thoughts on that.
I'd rather you start with Amanda. No. I think I'm not as familiar with the 20-year history that you mentioned before. I think, to me, the way I'd answer that is the encouragement. Even though it's taken us a while to get there and we've been behind a number of states, just in the last couple of years, there have been two pilot programs that the state has funded through the legislature. And the first one was created at the same legislation that created us, the Early Learning Advisory Committee. And another one that is currently running that is focused on five counties that have demonstrated the ability to basically take this and run with it. But there's two pilots now that the state has funded with some matching private dollars that will demonstrate, hopefully conclusively and once and for all, the difference in these high-quality educational experiences versus similar kids who don't have that and will be able for the first time to actually measure that, to evaluate that over a couple of year period and on into third grade to see if those milestones truly are being reached. Because let's face it, John, I mean, it is a not inexpensive proposition for the state to step up to this. And I think part of the issue has been people have looked at the price tag and said, wow, that's a lot of money. But if we can demonstrate and document that it's money well spent because it is actually delivering what the state is very interested in, and that is well-educated, thoughtful graduates who become productive citizens, that is very definitely money well spent.
Is some of the problem, Amanda, it seems to me so many of our discussions, not just about education, but any sort of public sector investment that might have a delayed benefit, as it were, comes down to, okay, instead of what will we get in return for this investment, the question simply becomes, what will this cost, not what the return will be on the investment. Is that part of the challenge here, is getting people to see, yes, you know, if you invest your money and your resources now, 20 years from now, you're going to see immense benefits?
I think that message is absolutely getting out there in the community. And as Kevin alluded to, there's been significant momentum in the last couple of years from a variety of stakeholders. And I think that's been really key in Indiana. We've had the business community who's really stepped up and encouraged the legislature and other community partners to see the value in investing early on in young children, and from a workforce standpoint, the value of making that investment and having those conversations and coming together with the public sector to say this is an important issue and let's move forward. And seeing that momentum has helped to create those two pilot programs that Kevin had alluded to, and actually in forming the Early Learning Advisory Committee. And now we do have such a variety cross-sector of membership, including business, philanthropy, public sector, and providers who are all coming around this issue to say, what can we do better in Indiana, and how can we learn from all the other states who've kind of been working at this a little bit longer than we have?
If you are just joining us, we are talking about early learning, early education here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Kevin, you mentioned that there were five counties that have demonstrated that they can take off and run with this. What are those five counties?
Marion County, Vandenberg County in the southwestern corner of the state where I'm from, Lake County in the northwest.
Indianapolis, Evansville.
Allen County, correct. Garrett. Allen County and Fort Wayne, and then Jackson County.
And Jackson County, which is down Seymour, area.
Yes, South Central.
Right.
Okay. So of those, four of them have fairly significant among four of the state's largest urban centers.
Correct.
Then. How are they demonstrating that they are taking off and running? What are the signposts for success here?
Actually, great question. When the legislature created this pilot program, which is called On My Way Pre-K, by the way, they actually had an application process, and 18 counties submitted about a 10-page document that said, here's who we have mobilized to speak into this issue. Here are some resources we can bring to bear on it. So it was in many ways kind of a competition among counties based in Indiana to demonstrate their ability to both raise the private sector match as well as have the infrastructure in place that could tackle this. And so after that competitive process of the 18 counties that submitted their proposals, a group met and looked over all of them, and that's how they determined these five were probably the lead candidates to take this initial run at it. Since then, the legislature has funded additional years of this, so we're optimistic. And there's another grant available to these other counties to take part in as well. So we're optimistic that the other 13 counties that submitted an interest can begin to take full advantage of this as well.
We talked about people getting pushed back by the price tag. I mean, if we're talking on an average $8,000 to $11,000 to make it relatively simple, if we're talking about 500,000 children who are of early and we use the $10,000 figure, you're talking about what is that? I'm trying to calculate the zeros in my head. Is that a $5 billion problem or a $50 billion problem?
It's a big number.
It is a big number.
Well, either way,
it's a big number. But which is why, John, to this point, I mean, it would be great to think in terms of universal access to this that the state would fund. But I think because of the affordability issue, the most pressing need is for those families who are at poverty or close to poverty level. So the two pilots that have been established, the first one tackled the families who had 100% of poverty as their annual income or less. The five-county pilot that I mentioned before takes that up to 127% of poverty or less because, again, the sense is those are the critical that's where the critical need is. Those are the families that frankly, have no way of affording this kind of high quality care if somebody doesn't intervene.
Well, mm-hmm. And if I'm recalling correctly, most of the research now shows that the childhood poverty has become a problem here.
Absolutely.
In the state. That
absolutely.
Some of the numbers say that as high as 22% of the state's children are living in poverty. So even if we just take that 22%.
Right.
Of those 500,000 children, that works out to more than 100,000 kids. It's still a big number. And how do we get there, Amanda?
And what we found in the report is that nearly 50% of our children, young families, are living at or below 185% of the federal poverty level. And so most states who do have a state-funded preschool program are using that threshold for families to enroll and participate in that program. They see the most value in really targeting to that population.
We are talking about early learning, early education here on No Limits. In sort of in response to the delivery of the Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee report on its findings to Governor Pence and the state's legislative council, if you'd like to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Brooke has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Brooke, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I had a question about the test, the quality levels, only because I have two children who are doing extremely well in a level two. That may be an isolated incident, but I was a little bit surprised to hear that the cutoff was a level three. So my question is, maybe you can speak a little bit more to those levels and what made your committee decide to cut it off after a level two.
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Brooke.
Thank you.
Whichever one of you would like to go.
Okay. Sure, I'll take a run at this and then give it to Amanda to amplify as well. Brooke, you've really raised a great question. Mm-hmm. The challenge across the state is to try to determine in a consistent fashion what makes for quality, what makes for a quality program so that parents can identify and have something to look to if they're going to spend $8,000 or $9,000 or $10,000 to invest in their child's early education. So Paths to Quality was put into place a little over 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I think, to identify in broad terms what characterized different and additional levels of quality across a wide array of faith-based, non-faith-based, center-based, home-based kind of providers to try to get some continuity and some consistency to it.
Go ahead, John.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say perhaps it would help people to know what distinguishes a two or three from a four.
Sure. Level Paths to Quality. So there in Paths to Quality, there are four levels. And so mm-hmm. level one is meeting basic health and safety standards is what we really look at. And then level two is really looking at having centers and having curriculum in place. That's level three is having the curriculum in place. And so meeting additional education standards related to having a schedule of activities. Mm-hmm. And then level three is really starting to look at the workforce and making sure the workforce has training and that they're equipped and that there's a good curriculum in place to ensure quality learning. And then level four is when a program is meeting rated as one of the nationally accredited programs approved by the state.
So to Brooke's question, we had to make a cut someplace to determine as best we could what would represent the highest level of quality. Having said that, it doesn't mean that there aren't excellent level two
right.
providers that are out there. And Brooke, it sounds like you're having that experience as well with the level two that your kids are going to. So that's certainly very much a possibility. We just, for consistency, we had to make sure that those dollars were going to centers that were in alignment with the kind of standards that Amanda just talked about.
So we should go ahead, Amanda.
I would say, and we should also mention that Paths to Quality is voluntary in the state. And so a provider is electing to participate in those levels, and they do scaffold. And so providers are at different points of readiness, and some of them are meeting those higher standards, and they just haven't contacted their local Paths to Quality coach to say, hey, we're already meeting the next level of standards. Let's come on out and get that next rating visit.
Yeah, Kevin.
So I was going to say the other thing that we were hopeful of is if we did set limits and said level three and level four are the ones that will be able to participate, that the level twos of the world would actually say, well, let us step up our game a little bit. Let's get certified as level three so that we can participate in this.
And it is voluntary. I should ask, of that 11% that we're talking about, does that include level one through four, or is that just levels three and
just
four?
Just levels three and four.
So there actually is more child care out there.
Right.
Do we have an idea how much, real quickly, or is that a question? Maybe we should take that after the break.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about early learning and early education. Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee has submitted its 2015 report of findings to the governor and the state's legislative council. I am talking with Kevin Bain, and Amanda Lopez, who helped assemble the findings. You are listening to No Limits. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible here on 90.1 by your membership and by Terry Lee Honda, offering direct access to Terry Lee every day. That's TLC, the Terry Lee Commitment. Terry Lee Honda in Avon on U.S. Highway 36. More at terryleehonda.com. And by Apparatus, announcing Whiteboard Wednesday, an opportunity to tackle business challenges with an apparatus technologist. More at apparatus.net/Whiteboard Wednesday. You can check WFYI.org on your mobile device. No app needed. Just click to WFYI.org and find all of our latest news at WFYI.org/news. You can join the conversation here on No Limits today by calling 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at No Limits. Stay tuned as No Limits continues here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee and its 2015 report of findings to Governor Mike Pence and the state's legislative council. This conversation is part of American Graduate, a series of continuing community conversations about the importance of graduation and education in general. It's a partnership between the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, this station, and many other community partners that tries to leverage the power of public broadcasting to carry on this important discussion. We've gotten a Facebook message, and if you'd like to reach out to us via Facebook, you can do so at No Limits WFYI. This is from Kim, and Kim says she missed the beginning of the program. We'll forgive you, Kim. But wanted to know if it's possible to get the report that you are talking about. Do you have a URL that people can go to?
Absolutely. Probably the best way to access the report would be to Google Indiana Early Learning Advisory Committee, and that will take you to the FSSA, Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning's page. And if you just scroll down about halfway on the page, you'll see a link there to the 2015 Early Learning Advisory Committee report.
Could you give it URL one more time? Because it's important. People don't, much as I wish they would, they don't sit there by the radio with a pencil in hand waiting for the
All of the information regarding ELAC, the Early Learning Advisory Committee, is hosted by the FSSA, Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning. And the easiest way to get to that webpage would be to Google Indiana Early Learning Advisory Committee. Click on that. That will take you directly to that government page. Scroll down about half of the way, and you'll be able to click on the 2015 Early Learning Advisory Committee annual report.
We've gotten a question from a listener named Ken. Says, I just wanted to point towards the employer in this conversation. It seems that engaging larger employers in the state in this need would be a benefit to everyone. On-site care certainly solves the issue of availability. The resource pool is also increased as subsidies or tax breaks to the company could be the government funding side. The employer becomes a much more competitive recruiter and fights lost productivity from missed work. And even the employee could have costs, but are far less than an outside private education facility. Why aren't not-for-profit organizations working closer with lawmakers and employers to bring these resources together? I'll let either one of you take that.
Sure. I think in many cases they are. I think that employers are seeing the value of this high-quality early care, and those that can, in many cases, are stepping up to having on-site care. I think, John, this also speaks to, you know, the question we talked about earlier that people are saying, well, gosh, yeah, we can invest in this, but it's 18 years down the road before you ever see the benefit of it. And the truth is it benefits today's workforce right
Absolutely.
Now. If they've got high quality care, they are at work. You know, they don't have to go take care of their kid because their provider fell through. They are more focused on the job. Productivity increases. And in fact, what we've seen, I mentioned before the private funding, what we've seen is a lot of these employers, in addition to just funding on-site childcare, they're the ones at the table who are making major donations to ensure that those other than their employees can have access mm-hmm. to the same kind of care, as they, care that they can offer.
And just to add to that, we know that in Indiana there are 152 employer-sponsored programs currently available. So absolutely, to the caller's point, that is a good opportunity. Employers are seeing the value in that and making it available through partnerships with local community-based programs.
Again, if you are just joining us, we're talking about early learning and early education here on No Limits with Kevin Bain, who's the president and CEO of Wellborn Baptist Foundation, and Amanda Lopez, president of Transform Consulting Group. They have worked intimately with Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee to do a 2015 report of findings. Got an email from a listener named Amy who says she's tuning into the program for the first time. Welcome aboard, Amy. Glad to have you. And says she's interested in what she's hearing. Her question is, how, and I'm assuming the you is not me here, how do you recommend someone could begin to get involved in ELAC or other ways to help with early childhood education, children in poverty, et cetera? Any websites or jumping off points would be greatly appreciated. I mean, well, yeah, either one of you at this point. And I could actually let both of you have a crack at that.
I think one great place to go, and I'm looking to you because I'm not sure exactly, again, what they might Google. But there are websites that are available that the listeners can go to that will actually identify high quality early childhood providers in their particular area. So they can start there, actually go on there to find out what opportunities are available in their area. Those sites are always looking for volunteer help, for citizens to come alongside and really help with that. I guess the best thing to do would be to just, again, Google Indiana Child Care Resource and Referral.
That could be a possibility. I think it just depends on what level of involvement do they want to have. And so as Kevin alluded to, there's an opportunity where you could volunteer your time and talent with a local early childhood education program, whether it's a school or a local community-based program. And so they're always looking for opportunities, whether to serve on their board or to get involved with the children in the programming. If they wanted to go to more of a community or regional level, there are many what I would call like local early learning advisory councils, if you will, that have different names. And so Vandenberg has a community up in Allen County. There's kind of a group meeting. And so there's opportunities to kind of help to move the discussion and address some of these issues of access, affordability, and quality at your regional or community level. And so you could get involved through that level. And then ELAC is at the state level. And so we're looking for different people who have expertise and knowledge in this area to serve on one of the seven work groups as well. And so I think depending on where the listener would want to be involved, their time and talent, there's opportunities across different levels.
And Amy, I would be remiss now that you are a member of the WFYI family of listeners, not to point out that you also can just call WFYI and talk to our community engagement folks, and they can provide some opportunities for you. I should ask, though, we started this conversation by talking about the 140 volunteers mm-hmm. for the Early Learning Advisory Committee. Where did those folks come from? I mean, if you want to, and is there for Amy or for anyone else who's interested, are there opportunities just to volunteer directly with ELAC?
There are. As Amanda talked about a minute ago, what we're looking for in terms of those volunteers is people who have content expertise, networking connections within the community. We have drawn, to answer your question, a lot of this was built just on word of mouth, that at, when ELAC was created and we started reaching out to the communities at large, I think we have at least 15 or 20 counties that are represented in terms of ELAC membership. Higher education people have raised their hand and said we'd like to be part. The business community, legislators, people from the executive branch, philanthropy, state employees, just a host of people who have both a passion and some content expertise have been those who have volunteered and been placed on one of seven work groups that focus on different aspects of this work.
Are there people who get turned away, though, who have volunteered and have not been placed?
You know, for the most part, I would say no. What we've tried to do is ensure that each one of those work groups has a geographic balance, so we're not too heavy up, for instance, on Marion County. Because things tend to, you know, centralize, obviously, around central Indiana. And we're not too focused on having just all academic participation or all business people, but we really like cross-representation.
And as you can see when you read the report, and I hope your listeners will take the time to read this report. It's really great information, if I do say so. I'm a little biased. But you'll see that these are working groups, and so they're not like other committees where you maybe just show up and we talk about issues. But there's been significant progress. There's a lot of work that's going into this. So these volunteers are really getting their hands dirty. They meet monthly and are making the commitment to travel here to Central Indiana to meet monthly and often have homework in between those monthly meetings to do follow-up action items to really start to move the agenda forward.
So what happens with this report now? I mean, and I hope I'm not insulting your profession, Amanda, but you know, the world is filled with consultants' reports that are produced with great fanfare and end up as doorstops or paperweights, you know, within just a few weeks after they've been delivered. Where do we go from here with this? What are the action steps?
Yeah, great question. So, in the report, in addition to the facts we've shared with you, we also highlight some of the progress that we've made as a state. And then part of our charter when we were created was to issue this report each year, and part of that was to issue specific recommendations to the governor's office, to the legislative council, about what we've learned in the past 12 months and what should be addressed going forward. So some of the recommendations we have are to formalize, for instance, I mentioned at the outset of the program, how all the information kind of resides all over the place, different departments, to formalize those relationships so that data sharing can take place. Mm-hmm. And we could literally be able to track, not with identifying the individual, but we could track an individual from their earliest experience in education all the way through graduation and be able to track their progress and be able to prescribe some remedial assistance, as well as in the aggregate to tell, are we really moving the needle at the state level on some of these? That was one of the recommendations we made, is to formalize that process. We've done things within the Early Learning Advisory Committee, like define family engagement tools, kindergarten readiness definition that we want to see broadly utilized. And so part of what keeps us from being a doorstop is to have specific recommendations to take this work that's been done by these 140 volunteers and embed it throughout the state in these departments that can actually make things happen.
And I should ask, because education has become such a minefield in this state. You know, we've had tremendous fights about this. What effect has the ongoing tug of war over education policy had on our efforts to move forward in this critical area?
I'll take a run at that. I think the composition of the Early Learning Advisory Committee has contributed greatly to trying to forestall some of that, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you one tangible example. We have both FSSA and the Department of Education seated at the table as working members of ELAC. Because of that, the new state standards that were established for K-12 education, we've recently spent the last 6 months or so with active involvement by the work group and specifically by the DOE representative, Charlie Geyer. They have pulled together early learning guidelines that match perfectly and feed into those K-12 standards for education to provide a seamless whole going forward. And that's a huge contribution to the cause, we think, so that the early learning guidelines are completely aligned with the K-12 educational standards.
Is there a will, do you think? I mean, any way you slice it, to really move the needle on this, it is going to require a greater investment on the part of state government. Is there a will to do that? I mean, we have become so tax averse and so spending averse. as part of our culture? Do you see that there is a possibility that any of these recommendations will be adopted, and which ones do you think are going to be the most attractive?
I really do. I'm encouraged by the fact that the pilot was not funded just on a one-year basis, but it essentially now has received a three-year commitment from the legislature, that they've actually funded an extensive study to determine the impact of investing, to your point. Mm-hmm. And I'm very optimistic, based on the experience with other states, that as we see the differences between kids in these high-quality early childhood settings and those who, frankly, are not, that the will for the state to invest in it will be clear because they will see the impact. They'll see the difference in kids arriving at kindergarten. Frankly, they'll see some of the remedial costs associated with it. If kids get to kindergarten and they're not ready to learn and they've got to be put into special education or some remedial efforts that are very costly, I think we're going to see over the course of the next couple of years a lot of hard data that supports this is an investment well worth making.
Go ahead, Amanda.
And I was going to say, and the other investment that the state has made that Kevin has alluded to as well is that there's also another preschool or pre-kindergarten pilot program that the state has funded. It's called the Early Education Matching Grant, and that's expanded the opportunities to 14 other counties across the state. So now we have nearly 20 counties who are participating in a pilot program to expand opportunities for low-income children and families to enroll their children in high-quality early learning programs. And so those will be continued to be funded for the next 2 years.
And I presume, since you've just submitted the 2015 report of findings, that means you have to get started on the 2016
that is very true. We already start making notes for what we want to submit next year.
What were the lessons learned from this report? I mean, are there things that you're going to be done differently? Are there problem areas or areas of interest that you intend to focus more attention on this coming year because of what you found?
Very much so. Let me give you one quickly, and that is with all of the interest in high-quality slots, as we talked about before, we need to have staffers. We need to have actually trained, educated professionals who are teaching those kids. And what we found is when we looked at the baseline of where we are and did a forecast, in terms of what the need for qualified professionals is going to be, there's a huge gap. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things we need to identify in the upcoming year is how can we fill that gap? How can we come alongside higher education providers and make sure that that gap is being filled by qualified professionals in the early childhood field?
Mm-hmm. Are there other areas, or is that the big one?
That's definitely a big one. And I think what we've learned from gathering this data and talking to the different partners who are collecting the information is that, as I mentioned earlier, there's gaps in the information. And so there are still questions that we want answered and information that we want to slice in a different way that we're not able to yet. And so we're talking with them about what are ways that we can improve the data collection efforts today so that the next report we have even more information to be able to answer those questions.
I think very quickly the other one would be family engagement. We see that as huge. We've talked a lot about the professionals, but the family is the first and most important teacher of these kids. And to the extent we can give them tips and techniques to interact with their kids in a high-quality way, that's a plus as well.
Go ahead, Amanda.
And as I mentioned, the appendix has much of this data available at the county level. And so that's another conversation that we're starting to have is how can we get this information to the local communities who are organized, who are coming together, or who do want to take this issue locally and start to move the needle and getting them the information that they need and the tools and resources to help to address some of these issues.
Real quickly, that leads – we ought to tell people one more time where they can find the report.
Absolutely. So if you Google Indiana Early Learning Advisory Committee, go ahead and click on that link, and that will take you to the FSSA, Office of Early Childhood and Out-of-School Learning's webpage. Scroll halfway down through that page. In the middle there, click on the 2015 ELAC Annual Report.
And that will be the last word. I'd like to thank my guest, Kevin Bain, President and CEO of Wellborn Baptist Foundation, and Amanda Lopez, President of Transform Consulting Group. They were talking about Indiana's Early Learning Advisory Committee and its report of findings. I'd also like to thank our audience. We will be back next Tuesday. We're going to be talking with the Republican candidate for mayor of Indianapolis, Chuck Brewer. So I hope you will tune in for that show. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.